Okay. I'd like to begin today, hopefully our last year on the topic of Emunah, with the Kuzari. A bit of background. Reb Yehuda Halevi was born in Toledo in Spain in the year 1075. He was a Talmud of the Rif in his youth. He was a friend of the Rimagash, who was the Rambam's Rebbe. He later became a great poet. He moved to Granada to be closer to Rav Moshe Ibn Ezra. He studied medicine, which was his profession. He married and had one daughter. According to legend, his daughter married the Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra. Besides the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote numerous poems and kinos, as we know, Tzion Halo Tishali, which we say on Tisha B'Av. And he eventually journeyed toward Eretz Yisrael, which was, of course, his lifelong longing, as expressed beautifully in his poetry. The Rav Gedalia ben Yahya, in his Shalshalas HaKabbalah, cites the famous story that you all know, that upon bowing when he entered Yerushalayim, he was trampled and killed by an Arab horseman. The most famous book written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, Rihal, is the Kuzari, which is what we're going to be studying today. It was written in Arabic. The translation into English of the title is actually The Book of Argument and Proof in Defense of the Despised Faith. So that's why people call it Kuzari. And the basic story is based off of a story which reached Spain in the 10th century but took place in the 8th century. The Khazar people lived on the shores of the Caspian Sea, and legend has it that the Khazar kings had a dream, same dream as his general, a repeated dream, in which case they're told that your thinking is pleasing to the Creator, but your actions are not. So this dream, this recurring dream, encourages the king to convene a debate. And actually, initially in the debate, a Jewish scholar was not sought who would be interested in the despised religion. So instead, there is a philosopher, a Christian scholar, an Islamic scholar. The king rejects Aristotelian philosophy. He notices that Christianity and Islam are built upon Judaism, so he says, well, maybe it makes sense to bring a Jew, which he does. The king is convinced about the correctness of Judaism, and he converts. That's described at the beginning of Book 2, and the conversation continues for 5 books until the Chaver, that's the Jewish scholar, announces that he's going to make Aliyah. Now, the book is really one of the classics of Machshava, and we're going to study today a small part of it, a number of quotes, as you can see, from the Kuzari, relating to Emunah. Let's go back for just one moment to the first sheet, to the first source, which is a medrash that over here that we saw earlier. The medrash describes Parshas HaShavua, Avram Avinu's discovery of the Ribono Shel Olam. Avram Avinu first asked philosophical questions, Tomar Shehaolam Hazeh Belo Manhig, and then the Medrash continues with Heitzitzalav HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Amar Lo Ani Hu Baal HaOlam. So while this Medrash highlights perhaps the value of initially asking philosophical type questions, it also does not end there. Instead, Avram's initial search leads to a conversation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It develops into a relationship. And that's really where we're going to begin with the Kuzari. First, very broadly speaking, the Kuzari contrasts someone who believes in God based off of philosophical speculation versus someone who believes in God because they have a relationship with God, or someone who has a relationship with God. The way the Kuzari puts it is the difference between the God of Avraham versus the God of Aristotle. Now, before reading his words, I guess we could present the idea in very broad strokes. Aristotle believed in God. Aristotle writes, and this is your second source on today's sheet, that there must be an immortal, unchanging being ultimately responsible for all the wholeness and orderliness in the sensible world. God essentially embodies absolute perfection. He's the unmoved mover, perfectly beautiful, indivisible, contemplating only the perfect contemplation, which is himself contemplating, whatever exactly that means. Now, by definition, though, HaKadosh Baruch Hu lacks ratzo. He could not create the world. That would imply something was initially lacking. He is simply the unmoved mover. That's it. He's just unmoved, mover, contemplating himself. Such a God cannot hear prayer. He cannot converse with prophets. He cannot interact with the world. Avram's God, Elohei Avraham, is totally different. He speaks to man. He cares about the world. He's involved in the world. He destroys the city of stone. He redeems the Jewish people from bondage. And most importantly, he loves Avraham. And the Avos Tachas Asher Ahav Avosav, as the Pasuk in Dvarim says, and Avram loves him. Avraham Ohavi, as the Pasuk in Yeshayahu says. So, with this in mind, let's read the words of the Kuzari. So, the Kuzari understands that the concept of an intimate relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Avraham's great innovation. There were believers before Avraham. There were tzaddikim before Avraham, Noach and Shem and others. And Avraham's innovation is reflected in his referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with the Shem Havaya. The Shem Havaya is an actual name, as opposed to simply speaking about God as God or Elohim. That's not a name. It's a description. It's not a name. The Shem Havaya, Yudke Vavke, is a personal name. Just like I refer to my friend Chaim with a personal name, when we refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu by the Shem Havaya, as Avram did, we're referring to him by his name, which reflects the beginnings of a relationship. Take a look at the first piece you have over here from Dalad Tazayan. Amar Kuzari, Hine Nisbar Eliya Hefresh Bein Hashemos Elokim Vashem. Vavinosi, Marav HaMerchak Bein Elokei, Elokei Avraham Uvein Elokei, Elohei Aristo. Right? I see the huge difference between calling God God versus Hashem versus Elokei, the God of Avraham and the God of Aristotle. The God of Aristotle is this concept. It's a concept. It's a concept that you arrive at, you could even prove through philosophy, through proof. It's a concept, though, as opposed to someone HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who are mishtokek a love. We yearn, we cleave, we love. Yes?
It seems like he's saying that the God of Avraham encompasses the God of Aristotle. It's not necessarily that they're so separate.
We're going to talk about that. He doesn't... We're going to get there. We're going to talk about, in just a couple minutes, his view on philosophy. It's also important to remember here. It's obvious, but just to make it clear that he's not criticizing the Rambam or Rav Haigon or Rav Sadia Gaon or Jewish philosophers. He's criticizing the Greek philosophers. Okay, continuing. Amar Achaver. Ein shem meduyak Yosef v'chashev Yosef min Hashem akasav be'osios yudkei vavkei. Yisborach v'yisroh ma'am. Zehu shem prati. Right, like we said, a personal name. Bo romzim lo betoar hamakom, kedach shromzim lakol metuar bilti yadua, v'lo betarim nosafim al atzmuso, v'lo b'achlala, k'v'shem haklali alokim, ki'im b'shem hamiyuchad lo. Shekein hu nikra Hashem al derech hayichud. Ki'ilu shal shoel, mihu elokim sheyesh lavdo? Hashemesh, Yareach, Shamayim, Mazalos, O Echad min HaKochavim, O Ha'esh, O Ha'ruach, O Ha'malachim, Ha'ruchaniyim, O Zulasam, Ki Halo, Kol Echad me'ele Pu'ula Mishalo, V'shelton Mishalo, Kol Echad me'em Sibas, V'hisavos, Dvarim, U'le'afseim, V'al Zeba, Tshuva Hashem, Ki Ilu Amarta Ploni, V'karasalo B'shem Ploni, Ruvin V'shimon L'mashal, So when we call HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hashem, it's not a description like Elohim or Kel or the like. It's his name. Just like Reuven and Shimon. He adds a caveat here, which is that there's an additional element, that Hashem reflects, the name of God reflects his essence. Like he says, Tivada mitas atzmusam. Frank may or may not reflect the essence of your friend. The Kuzari elaborates upon that actually in the second book. I didn't give this to you, but there he writes, Kol HaShemos HaLoka, with the exception of the Shema before Shem, Sipurim Utarim Nosafim Al Atzmuso Shekulam Shoalim Mehespa'aluyo Shenivraim Nifalim Megzeru Savu Mimasav. Okay. Yes.
I mean, according to the popular idea that, you know, a person's world, of course, when they give names, so do we say that?
I'm not saying anything about that right now. Now, the Rav, but yeah, that idea, it reflects the idea that to some degree, parents are given siyata dishmaya in naming a child, to choose a name that's appropriate for that child. Not necessarily to the same degree as what's being, you know, the way in which the Shem Havayah captures HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence, but yes, to perhaps a similar concept.
But Shem Havayah was Avram's invention?
Well, I don't know if it's
the first time it appears.
It's not. It's the first time it appears in conversation. In other words, we don't, as far as I know, have Adam HaRishon or Noach referring to God as Hashem. In Avram, he does. How he came to that.
By Moshe says, right, like, this is my name, this is how you should refer to me. Do we have that by Avram somewhere?
No, not at least not recorded, as far as I know. But we have him call Hashem Elokim in our Parsha. Hashem, Avram calls Hashem. In this week's parsha, he addresses him as Hashem Elokim by the Shem Havayah.
Is that like his invention, or that's
well, he didn't make it up. So Avram wasn't the person who made up the Shem Havayah, but he was the first to relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through that name. Before we go on, in the Kuzari, the Rav develops this idea. He doesn't really attribute it to the Kuzari, but I think the ideas of the Kuzari very powerfully in The Lonely Man of Faith. And in The Lonely Man of Faith, the Rav, of course, relates to the two different creation narratives, the first one, which is basically Perek Aleph and the first couple of Psukim of Perek Beis, and then the second creation narrative, which is basically Perek Beis. And he does this by describing two archetypes, Adam 1, which is man in the first chapter, and Adam 2, man in the second creation narrative. The first chapter, of course, refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Elohim, Bereshis Bara Elohim. The Shem Havaya doesn't appear in Perek Aleph of Bereshis. And thus, Adam 1 relates to HaKadosh Baruch Hu only to the cosmic God. Adam 2, on the other hand, and here you have a quote, and again in today's sheets, Adam 2 studies the universe with naivete, awe, and admiration of the child who seeks the unusual and wonderful in every ordinary thing and event. Adam 2 is often, in the Rav's writings, compared to a child, which is very powerful. We have to awaken that child within us. He looks for the image of God not in the mathematical formula or the natural relational law, but in every beam of light, in every bud and blossom, in the morning breeze, and in the stillness of a starlit evening. Adam 1 uses his practical intellect, his scientific ability to comprehend the forces of nature, and his technical ability to bend them at his will. Adam 2 doesn't have such a grandiose self-image. He is humble, he realizes he's created from the dust of the earth, but he allows himself to be overpowered and defeated by God. Adam 1, and this is what's most important, retains distance from the Rivona Shel Olam. He relates to HaKadosh Baruch Hu from a distance. Adam 2 has a genuine living experience. He's preoccupied with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How does HaKadosh Baruch Hu create Adam 2? By breathing life into his nostrils. His very creation is the most intimate act. He kisses him. He blows into him. And that is reflected by the Shem Havaya, which of course appears in the second creation narrative. He's not satisfied with that impersonal encounter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He looks and craves for the intimate relationship. And that's, in the words of the Kuzari, what Avraham Avinu discovers. Now, turning back, well, let's try to build the broader thing, and then we'll see. If I don't take questions, if I don't address these points. It's not simply that philosophical demonstration fails to yield a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it fails to prove that a relationship is even possible. Philosophy can prove the existence of a deity, but it does not prove that he hears us, he interacts with us. That, the Kuzari explains, can only be known through prophecy. Take a look at the next quote. Amar Kuzari. This is the king talking. Ve'ech ekra b'shem miyuchad es she'en lirmoz alav v'chol ra'ayasi alav mipu'ulazav hi. Right? We only can see, detect in the world God's actions. So how do I relate to something like that? And the Chavar responds, Yesh v'yesh alav remez be'edos hanevua ubrias halev ki havas harayos mitae umimena noldu haminus vashitos hanefsados. We know this through nevuah. Demonstration, philosophy can lead people astray. Demonstration, philosophy is the mother of heresy and destructive ideas. Right? How is it that philosophy that proves the existence of God leads to heresy? Because it proves the existence of the wrong God. It proves the existence of a deity that exists, but it doesn't prove the existence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the Shem Havaya, who relates to us. I'll just read this in English. There are differences in the ways of demonstration, of which some are more extended than others. Those who go to the utmost lengths are the philosophers, and the ways of their arguments led them to teach of a supreme being who neither benefits nor injures and knows nothing of our prayers, offerings, obedience, disobedience, and that the world is eternal. Right? Just think about what we talked about last week. We said, well, you know, there are all sorts of things that science can't prove. why anything should exist, the evolution of consciousness. Okay. That proves, let's assume it proves anything. So what would it prove? It proves that there's a creator. It proves that we are created beings. But it doesn't prove that we can and should have a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. It doesn't prove that he listens to our tefillos and he cares about us and he's involved in the world, at least at present, not just as a watchmaker, as a creator. The first man never would have known him if he had not addressed, rewarded, and punished him. In other words, Adam knew HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not because simply God created him, but because God interacted with him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu talked to Adam HaRishon. And that's how Adam knew of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kuzari then explains how his name, the Shem Havaya, became known and how it became forgotten. Again, we'll just read the English. This is not a great translation, but it's good enough for now. With this, Adam would have been satisfied with the name Elohim. Adam would have been satisfied with the name Elohim, neither perceiving what he was, whether he was a unity or many, nor whether he was cognizant of individuals or not. Cain and Hevel were made acquainted with the name of his being by the communications of their father, right? Adam was a Navi, as well as by prophetic intuition. Then Noach, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, and the prophets called him intuitively Hashem. Again, the Chol Eilek Ra'uhu Hashem. I don't know where intuitively comes from. We'll have to look back at the Arabic, right? But anyway, as did the people, having been taught by tradition that his influence and guidance were with men. His influence, also being with the pious, they comprehended him by means of intermediaries called glory, shechina, dominion, fire, clouds, likeness and form, appearance of a rainbow. For these things proved to them that he had spoken to them, and they called it the glory of Hashem, Kvod Hashem, or sometimes Hashem. The Kuzari then goes ahead and shows how there are various differences with respect to the way in which a person will relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with whom he has a connection, versus again, the God of Aristotle. First and foremost, with respect to sacrifice. A person who believes in God based off of philosophy, someone who serves the God of Aristotle, will not sacrifice his life, right? Imagine Donald Trump becomes, after his second term expires, decides to become the king. and not only that, but he makes everyone say that that all triangles made by a King Trump have a hypotenuse that is longer than their two sides. And you have to make such a statement. And if you don't, you'll be executed. So what does it make sense to do? So it doesn't necessarily make sense to give up your life, even though you know it's false. But it's not really worthwhile to give up your life for a triangle. So you might know something is false, but you're unlikely to sacrifice your life, whether it's giving your life literally or sacrificing your life while you're alive, for that truth. Whereas when you have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God isn't just a concept, but he's the object of your greatest love. So then that will naturally inspire sacrifice. the God of Aristotle is an idea. It's external to the person. It's not part of the person. For that matter, the God of Aristotle wouldn't demand sacrifice because he doesn't demand anything. Right? Take a look over here in Dalet Hazayin. A relationship with God invites its votaries to give their lives for his sake and to prefer death to his absence. Speculation, however, makes veneration a necessity only as long as it entails no harm, but it bears no pain for its sake. I would therefore excuse Aristotle for thinking lightly about observation of the law, the observance of the law, since he doubts whether God has any cognizance of it. The Akedas Yitzchak, you have this in your next source, highlights this point, that is the purpose of Akedas Yitzchak. The purpose of Akedas Yitzchak is to highlight this innovation of Avram Avinu, the notion that one will naturally be willing to sacrifice for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because as he writes, where it's bolded over here, the midas philosoph tiv'i lema'alas torani eloki ki bederach philosophim ein sichlos gedola mizu. There could be nothing more foolish than sacrificing yourself, sacrificing your beloved child. But Avram Avinu, in the greatest expression of love and fear, is willing to, and he says that's the progression of Avram and his nisyonos, starting with Mila and culminating in Akedas Yitzchak. We noted last week the observation of the Chassid Yaivitz that history reflects that reality, that the Jews of Spain who were philosophically inclined were less likely to make that ultimate sacrifice, whereas those who possessed simple faith but a powerful relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu eagerly were willing to sacrifice everything else for their belief. So, to summarize, a person who accepts only the God of Aristotle will not be willing to give up his life really for two reasons. First of all, if your faith rests entirely on reason, then you'll lack the will to sacrifice for his belief, for this belief. And moreover, it's totally irrational. Now, the Kuzari then turns to the transition of Avram Avinu. As we noted before, the Medrash states that Avram Avinu did originally come to a recognition of God through speculation, through philosophical type questions. The point, though, is that after he arrived at that, and after he came to develop a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's no point, there's no value in that sort of speculation anymore. We'll see a little later when we consider the writings of the Rav. The Rav frequently quotes Kierkegaard to this effect, in which he depicts the foolishness, the absurdity of someone lovingly embracing their lover and then starting to wonder, do they really exist? Or how could they prove that they exist? You're in love. You're embracing them. You don't have to, there's no value in being able to prove. So proof might have value in terms of discovering HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This relates to the point that you asked last week. Nobody, you know, we quoted the Rebbe Chanan last week, who said that b'makom teshchichi hazeka, then even those Rishonim who valued proof would not encourage proof. That statement, of course, is said only with respect to someone who already believes. If you already believe, then you could say it's best not to seek proof or evidence, because that act of seeking evidence might question your belief. But if you don't believe, then you have no choice but to approach the matter philosophically. That's what the Kuzari writes. But once you have that faith, there's no point. Not just because it's dangerous, but on a much more fundamental level, because it's absurd. It's silly. So take a look here at the Kuzari. Once v'itachen ki ha'iyun hazeh she'matzanu b'sefer Yetzira ha'iyuno shel Avraham Avinu sha'a shekvar nisbariru lo achdus ha'aloka v'abosenu ach terem zachal lehizgalos. In other words, prior to prophecy, Avram Avinu needed this type of thing. Ulam, la'achar shezachal lehizgalos, once he was zocha to nevuah, v'yomer Hashem al Avram, lach lecha me'artu b'chal l'anjuch b'ezmicha. And, by the way, it's very important to note that at the very least, the Torah Shebichsav totally omits the earlier parts of his life. The only thing we know of Avram Avinu in the Torah is really Avram Avinu of Parshas Lech Lecha, the post-prophecy Avram Avinu. None of his early history, when he discovered God, when, as we read about a couple of weeks ago, served Avodah Zarah, right? None of that's there. What's important to us, at least from the Tarsha B'chsav perspective, is the Avram Avinu who experiences Nevuah. And after, says the Kuzari, he was Zochel is Galos, Azav as Kol HaAkeshim, he abandoned all that philosophy. The Lo Bikesh Me'im Aloka, Ki Im Lios Lo L'Ratzon, Acharei Asher Lamdu Aloka, Mahu HaRatzon, Vame Yusag Uve'eze Makom, Ukfar Darshu Achachamim Al Mamar Kasav, right? Very fascinating interpretation of Tzemetz Dagnino Shalcha. It's not the way Rashi seems to understand it in terms of his mazel as to not being able to have a child. But forget science, forget philosophy. You don't need that anymore because you have Nevuah. It's an interesting question. In other words, it sounds like from the Kuzari that the Rambah, well, first of all, that was pretty early, right?
It wasn't right.
Well, that's a point. When is that from and when did that take place? Right? The Bris Bein HaBesarim might have taken place before Lech Lecha. You have to work out the cheshbon, I forget how it works. But even besides that, what I think the Kuzari implies a little bit is perhaps a little bit of a development within Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu appreciated this on his own with his first nevuah. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu emphasizes even more when he says, Tzei Mitzdag Nino Shulcha. Now, yes?
Two things. First of all, the fact that he needed to be told, same as Agneo Shelfa, you know, shows that...
Again, that's the same question. Avram Avinu, he says, realized it on his own, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's what the Kuzari writes, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu obviously taught him something that's even more tief when he told him this.
And so one of the things that was mentioned was that if a person doesn't have the belief yet, then he has no choice but to, you know, go to the philosophy in order to build that belief. But then after, you know, mm-hmm. he actually is able to recognize it, goes far, then you can abandon the philosophy. Does that may have been true for Avraham Avinu where there was no other...
Yes,
you know,
correct.
In the world. But for other people, is it possible to be
yes.
in that belief without...
Getting yes, we're going to talk about that. Possibly. And of course, one of the things we need to talk about a lot, but we're going to get there first, is what this means in the post-prophetic world. Because as we see, prophecy is a very big part of this. What does that mean for us, as I imagine none of us are Nevi'im, as of yet? But before we get there, the position of Rabbi Yehuda Levi on philosophy is is a bit more nuanced than what we've been saying. A lot of times people sort of present it as Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was an anti-rationalist. And we'll see, he doesn't categorically reject philosophy, and there's a value and a purpose of it. Let's take a look here. This is from much earlier in the Sefer. Ein lavo betainos, ho'el v'heim anashim shelo kiblu chachma odas b'yerusha, shehareihem yavanim, v'yavan hum ibnei yafes yosh v'atzafon. So we have no tainos on the Greeks, on the philosophers, because they didn't have a Yerusha of religion. Given their lack of tradition and their lack of exposure to Nevuah, to revelation, the Greeks had to rely entirely on speculation in searching for wisdom and truth. And he writes, those of them that were humble and intellectually honest acknowledged their limitations and were very successful. Again, in the next piece, Achein ha-philosophim, im amnam rachku kol herche kazeh me'asagas ha-aloka lefi ha-nevua, ein la-hashimeim, we don't blame them, al-kach, ki el-chachmas ha-alokus lo hayalahem mivo, ki im derech ha-hekesh ha-hagyoni, va-hekesh lo heviam, ki im lemashe amarnu. V'achein osam mehem ha-oavim lehodos al-ha-emes, Yomru Labali Torah, Dvarim Sha'amar Socrates, Chavre Ha'ezrachim, Chachmas Elokus, Zua Sherlachem, Ein Ani Makrisha, Ulam, Omer Ani, Kieni Makira, Kieni Odea Rak, the Chachma Ha'enoshis. Right? In other words, all that they had was Chachma, and actually, he writes, that with their chachma they were able to accomplish a great deal. A little later he writes that a HaKadosh Baruch Hu bestowed upon human beings the powerful gift of the intellect. And it's not just that the intellect can lead a person to belief in God, but also can help a person live a virtuous life. Again, we'll just read the English here. They are full of doubts, and there is no consensus of opinion between one philosopher and another. Yet they cannot be blamed. They deserve thanks for all they have produced in abstract speculations. For their intentions were good. They observed the laws of reason and led virtuous lives. In other words, you can really go pretty far, both in terms of appreciating God's existence and the life of virtue and the like with philosophy. However, the emphasis of the Kuzari is that the Jewish people have something that even the greatest philosophers lacked, and that is nevuah, that is revelation, and a correct conception of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In a certain sense, the Kuzari writes that revelation picks up where philosophy leaves off, and philosophy can get you pretty far, but only so far. And through Nevuah, we, the Jewish people, were zoche to go further. It's actually a little reminiscent of a comment that the Gra makes about philosophy. The Gra, as he notes in two places in Shulchan Aruch, was not a particular fan of philosophy. He talks about philosophy harura, that was mate, the Rambam, with respect to certain things. But at the same time, we have to appreciate, as the Kuzari writes, that philosophy, science, and the like, in a sense, do come from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They are a avenue, a means by which a human being can, if utilized correctly, arrive at the truth. Our seichel, which is the source of what we discover in science and philosophy and the like, is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ki Hashem yitem chachma mipiv gal, right? It's chachma's mipiv. And a person through science, through philosophy, can make a lot of progress. Here's the quote from the Gra. philosophia, Amar Rabbeinu, she mimakom she mistayim ha-philosophia, misham ulemala maschil chachmas ha-kabbalah. In other words, Kabbalah begins where philosophy ends. Philosophy, science, that is an avenue by which a person can apprehend the truth. But it's more limited because our minds are limited. Whereas revelation or Kabbalah, which comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, can get us further. Even says that Kabbalah Sa'ari picks off from where Kabbalah of the Ramak left off and the like. So that being the case, the Kuzari writes, Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. If you take a look at this, the last quote we have from him, these are the rational laws being the basis and preamble of the divine law, preceding it in character and time, Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah, and being indispensable in the administration of every human society. Even a gang of robbers must have a kind of justice among them if their confederacy is to last. So the point is that a person, a human being, especially the Kuzari emphasizes, if he's humble and honest in his search, can get pretty far with respect to truth, science, virtue, using reason alone. And that's why he repeatedly says, we don't have tinus on the Greeks, because they did a pretty good job. Yes?
But how does this fare with the Quran in Shulchan Aruch, that all the philosophy is garbage?
He doesn't say all the philosophy is garbage anywhere in Shulchan Aruch. He writes that, as far as I understand, we could work on that another shiur, he writes that certain mistakes that the Rambam made were because he was overly influenced by philosophy. So the context for their example is that the Rambam's rejection of Shadim or magic or the like is because he was influenced methodologically by philosophical thinkers. He doesn't say it's garbage. Adarabba. He, in a number of places, including here, highlights its value and accomplishment like the Kuzari does as well. The Gra also felt that all Chachma could be acquired through Torah, meaning to say you don't need it. You don't need philosophy or you don't need the Greeks for science. But he also writes that it's not always the most efficient way to apprehend science through Torah because not everybody, even though Torah does contain everything that's true in all Chachma, it's not necessarily the case that most people will be able to perceive it through Torah.
Right, but in the Maeserach, he went through all of the philosophy, and he says, it's all right to be sorry for Ashba, aside for two things.
Maybe another shiur. The Gra's position on philosophy is unclear. And among his Talmidim, there is machlokas. Among his Talmidim in their published works while he was alive, there seems to be machlokas. So I can't be machria, and there's the debate about the Vilna Gaon's precise position on philosophy is one that's as far as I could tell unsettled, but at the very least, this is one perspective. Yes?
Could you explain that last point?
Derech Eretz Kadma, well, let's read it. Eile v'chol hadomim lahem heim hachukim ha-sichliyim. Achalalu enam kiyim hatzos v'hakdamos l'torah ha-lokis. Meaning to say, like we said before, Torah revelation picks up where philosophy leaves off. Meaning to say that, philosophically speaking, you can come to a certain understanding of what is virtuous, what's right, what's good, how to live how to run a society. And Torah, and that's the way the world existed until Matan Torah, right? what Torah does is, and that's in fact the correct and proper way for non-Jews who don't have the Torah to live, using their seichel to figure out what to create the best, most fair, equitable society they can. Torah, and Derech Eretz Kadem LaTorah, Torah, there is truth and value to that. Torah then goes further than what a human being would be able to accomplish on their own. So, right, so philosophy or political science or virtue ethics was kodemes la, preceded the Torah, b'teva uvizman, both in character, meaning to say you can, and chronologically, that's derech eretz kadma l'Torah, right? There were many generations of derech eretz before matan Torah. In those generations, a society was meant to be governed through seichel. And also, he says in teva, meaning to say fundamentally, in other words, a person has to figure out what's right. But then Torah takes that further and tells us that which we would not be able to know on our own. Yeah.
Do you remember where the Gra is that he says that it's not the most efficient way necessarily to learn other concepts?
There's a couple of places where he implies that. The most famous one is from his Talmud, what he quotes in the Hakdama to his translation of Euclid. That is a controversial work, but I think the Pashtus is that it's authentic. That was published during his lifetime. So he tells him that you know, he encouraged him to translate Euclid for that reason, right? If you could get it more efficiently through Torah.
Implication.
Yeah.
I understand
that
he said that it was
like,
Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah is the best way for Andrew to go about things. And there is a demo of, like, it's not the best for us. Why does it seem like that line is something that we would use all the time?
The term Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah has more than one meaning. It's used differently. You know, the way your third grade teacher used it when she told you, you know, not to make a Chol Hashem when you're, you know, visiting the science museum is not necessarily the way he's using it. But take a look. The Maral actually has in one place, translates it more that way. That's you could understand the concept of Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. He's not actually quote those words, but in a couple of ways. One is more in terms of chronology. Another one is a different understanding, which is that, you know, if you don't have Derech Eretz, then your Torah is messed up. So take a look at the Maral on that. Okay, I'd like to. How much time do we have? We finished the first third of what we're supposed to do today. The second third is to talk about applying the Kuzari in the modern world. And then the third third is to talk about other thinkers on Emuna. Especially I wanted to talk about Rav Kook, the Baal HaTanya, and the Rav. We'll see what we get to. Okay. So, as we noted before, the Kuzari's approach is very focused on Nevuah. And one question that it leaves us with is what does that mean for us in the post-prophetic world? Take a look at, we're going to turn now to the sheets from last week, the ones that we didn't finish. And there are, obviously, the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu continues. It is rooted in our understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which we gain through prophecy, but the type of relationship that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that Avram enjoyed with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is one that we continue to strive for, even in the post-prophetic world. Obviously, we don't serve Elokei Aristotle, we serve Elokei Avraham. And the question is, how do we accomplish that? And there are a number of powerful ways in which we interact, powerful encounters that we have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the first one we'll discuss today, since it's what we do all day, is Talmud Torah. Take a look at this passage here you have from Rav Dessler. Hisalos be'emuna pnimius ba'a al yedei hisamkus batorah atma, namely, learning be'iyad, v'lo al yedei chakiros haseichel mufshetes. And it's a beautiful piece, you could keep on reading it, but we encounter HaKadosh Baruch Hu every day, hopefully, through our learning. Now, knowledge of God's existence through Talmud Torah is different than knowledge of his existence through philosophical proof, but it's no less certain. It might not convince a person who hasn't experienced it, but I think for those who are zochet, who have experienced it, the encounter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Talmud Torah leaves one with no doubt. It's not just... So that's one aspect. There's more to say, but we're going to move quickly. Talmud Torah is not the only experiential way to encounter God's existence. We do it through Shmiras HaMitzvos, certainly through genuine tefillah, through Dikduk BeHalacha, Shmir Shabbos in particular, is one of the powerful ways in which a person can strengthen their emunah. The Ali Shur writes about that in Chelak Aleph Per Gimel, and Stipler and others about how, again, chizuk and emunah through Talmud Torah, through Shmir Shabbos, through tefillah. And also, of course, many of our everyday experiences. Now, the first question, I think, on this approach that we have to consider is whether experiential knowledge is a cop-out. You know, sometimes people will feel like, you know, in light of science, okay, so the best we could do is have experiential awareness and knowledge of God. That's clearly wrong. As we've seen in the Kuzari, I thought the following conversation, which is by Gary Guttening with himself, you'll see in a second, sort of expresses this, and then we'll see it in more traditional sources. Okay, so, but again, you have this over here. But at least aren't believers who appeal to religious experience and metaphysical arguments admitting what popular atheism so insistently claims, there's simply no evidence for God's existence, and that alone warrants atheism? There's no scientific evidence, but there are other sorts of evidence. I suspect that most atheists, works better if you have two different voices, think scientific evidence, evidence that ultimately appeals only to empirically observable facts, is the only evidence there is. That may be their assumption, but how do you know that's correct? It certainly isn't supported by scientific evidence, since that tells us about only what is empirically observable. The question is whether there is anything else, right? In other words, a lot of times when people appeal to science, they're looking in the wrong place. And even science doesn't claim that that would be the right way to observe it. It reminds me, I was once talking to a very intelligent person who about the neshama. And he said something, you know, which is, anyone who studies philosophy or psychology nowadays, they always start with, you know, does the mind exist? Is there any... So he said, like, you know, there's no, you know, there's a lot of evidence that it doesn't exist, that there's no such thing as a soul, he said. But what evidence? He says, well, you know, they did MRIs and brain scans, and nobody's ever seen the soul. So I said, well, would you expect to see the soul in a brain scan? In other words, again, he realized afterwards it's a little silly, but you know, you wouldn't expect to see something non-physical in a test that's looking for something physical. And I think that's a very important point here. I was reading, actually, just recently, the Rav, it's written in The Emergence of Ethical Man, talking about this precise point, which is that, you know, science, the question of the emergence of man is not one that science seeks to answer. There's another point here, which is very much related, and this is a much more fundamental point here that the Ramban makes, and this is the, I think, for the Ramban, the major error that philosophy and philosophers make. Again, here it's said in one place with respect to concepts like kishuf, but it's really much broader. So this is the critique in the Ramban here of the ancient Greek philosophers. Ki ayinu tzrichim lachsom pi hamischakmin betava hanemshachrin achare hayivanim hayivani asher hikchish kol davar zulasi hamurgashlo. Basically, he denies, is presumably talking about Aristotle, anything that he could not apprehend with his senses. Meaning to say, if you can't see it, or it doesn't come up in a scan, then it doesn't exist. V'higiz da'ato lachshov hu v'talmidav harishayim ki kol inyan shelo hisig elav hu b'svaraso ein ha'emes. Right? Anything, and Ramban notes, it's tremendous gaiva, anything that he couldn't understand isn't true or doesn't exist. And when we talk about experiential knowledge of God's existence and the validity of these encounters as serving as the basis or part of the basis of our belief in God, it's very important to keep that in mind. One of the most powerful essays on this topic is written by Rav Lichtenstein. And it's it's actually somewhat different than a lot of his other writings. I think it was first published in the Jewish Action, the OU magazine. And actually in Rav Sabato's interviews with him, he develops a lot of these ideas even more clearly. But we'll read it from here. Recently, in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of talk about this essay. But it really speaks for itself. So again, he's discussing the source of faith. The greatest source of faith, however, has been God himself. Meaning to say exactly what we've been talking about. Encounters with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the basis for emunah. It's not something coming from without, but from within. And here's a very important point that I'd like to say. This is a point that Rav Kook makes. If we have time, we'll develop it later. A lot of times, people contrast philosophy versus tradition, mesora, right? The two venues, the two means by which a person comes to belief in God is either proof or tradition. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about something else. We're talking about knowing God from without versus discovering God from within. When a person proves the existence of God through the cosmological argument, so it's coming from outside of them. They observe the universe, they conclude based off of their observations that God must exist. Nothing else could account for the existence of the universe. Versus the experiential approach that we're discussing, that the Kuzari is discussing, which is something that comes from within. And it's superior precisely because it comes from within versus without. Someone who believes just because their parents told them to believe is no different than someone who believes because they proved it studying philosophy. In both cases, it's coming from outside of them. Now, it could be that their parents telling them to believe, you know, their upbringing cultivates within them this inner source of belief. But that's what we're discussing. So that's what he means. The greatest source of faith is God himself. Is our encounters with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the most powerful source of faith. Encounter, of course, has been varied. And I think we all experience that. There are times in our lives when we feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence very powerfully and closely, and there are times when we don't feel it. In part, it has been channeled primarily through Talmud Torah, right, HaMa'or Sheba, as Chazal put it, but also through prayer, Shemir Samitzvos, or if you will, by the halachic regimen in its totality. In part, it has been random. Moments of illumination while getting on a crowded bus or watching children play in a park at twilight. Right? We have those moments where we're overwhelmed with a feeling of appreciation and closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the triggers can be totally, seemingly random. Obviously, it's greatly varied in intensity. In its totality, however, whatever the form and content, it has been the ultimate basis of spiritual life. Now, one issue that one has to deal with here is, what if I don't experience God, right? Okay, it's very nice. I read about Rav Lichtenstein's powerful experiences of God when he walked into a bus and when he studies Torah. But what if I don't experience any of that? I've gone to buses and I've never felt HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I learn Torah and it's sometimes interesting and sometimes boring, but I never feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu when I'm doing that. When you're talking about rational proof, so you could attempt to convince the skeptic. But when it comes to experiential knowledge, it really only seems to help someone who's experienced or someone who's open to experiencing it. So Rav Lichtenstein addresses this problem. This will obviously provide little guidance for those to whom attaining encounter is precisely the problem. To those struggling to develop faith, one can, however, prefer first the reassuring assertion of the religious significance of the quest per se, as in the footsteps of Avraham, they have already begun, become seekers of God. The quest itself is very powerful and important. The Rav writes in a number of places about how a lot of times you have a question and you ask the question and you have no answer and you're going around in circles and circles and circles. You have to appreciate that even when you're going around in circles, seemingly, and you don't yet have a solution, you're actually making progress. And along similar lines, the quest, seeking out HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is itself valuable. Second, the prospective hope of successful resolution, as the Lord is good unto them that yearn for him, to the soul that seeketh him. And third, the counsel to focus persistently in terms of Coleridge's familiar distinction upon faith rather than belief, upon experiential trust, dependence, and submission, upon more than upon catechetical dogmatics. Intellectual assent is normative and essential, but at the personal level, it is generally not the key. In the final analysis, the primary human source of faith is faith itself. All right, I said today was going to be the last one, maybe the first half of next year we'll finish, because there are some very important things to continue. I just leave you with one last thought. I think really, in a sense, the most important thing on a practical level is to daven. You might say that someone who is struggling with faith. So if you don't have faith, what's the point of davening? It seems absurd, but really on the contrary. Hashem listens to our tefillos, and we have to turn to our Kadosh Baruch Hu to help us achieve that closeness to Him. And if we do that, then our Kadosh Baruch Hu will help us achieve that faith, that certainty, and that closeness. Okay, have a good Shabbos. Yes.
Oh, I was wrong. Good. I don't know.